Today on Against the Grain, coronavirus-related reporting dominates the news these days, but burning political issues, of course, linger. Issues of justice and injustice, historical truth, and collective amnesia. Although this year's Left Forum conference has been canceled, we found some commentary delivered at Left Forum 2019 that is still fresh and urgent. I'm CS. You'll hear from a number of political thinkers and commentators coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Left Forum, the New York City-based nonprofit that brings together progressive and radical folks to share ideas about social change, hosts an annual conference. This year's gathering, originally scheduled for May 29th through 31st, has been canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's unfortunate, but what's fortunate is that many of the presentations given at last year's Left Forum remain timely and relevant, and we've gained access to some talks that we'll present this hour. You'll hear from four thinkers and writers. Danny Haifong is an activist and journalist, and he's co-author with Roberto Servent of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Glenn Ford is executive editor of Black Agenda Report. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights attorney and the author, most recently, of The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. We begin with Kimberly Westcott. Westcott is associate counsel at the Community Service Society of New York and an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University's School of Social Work. She spoke at Left Forum as part of a panel called Double Jeopardy: Crises in Economic Life and in Relationships in the U.S. Today. The panel was held on June 30, 2019, at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus. On hand to record the panel was Wilton Vaught. Here's Kimberly Westcott.
So unfortunately, as we see again and again, as long as attitudes and values reinforce the existing power structure, the world of the past is our present and future. But it's also possible to learn from the forces and systems of control that culminated in the late 20th century. This includes not only examining the roots and the impact of capitalism as we tried to survive under it, but also examining the process and the effect of chattelization and enslavement, and exploring on a personal level what it means to embody property and what is required to struggle to move beyond that economically and culturally. There are at least three interconnected systems of hierarchy: capitalism, patriarchy, and white supremacy. These systems valorize power from extracted wealth, male dominance, and whiteness, whatever that is. Capitalism effectively integrates and builds upon all of these systems. The United States history is marked by the people of the African diaspora's ongoing struggle to break free from the legal and the economic and the social status of being defined as property, from the violence used to keep us in our place, and the stress of being forced to live under institutions that feed these conditions day after day. When your kids are routinely shot by the police, your schools have no resources and convey your children to prison by design, and people look at you on the subway or the street as though you define the lowest rung in the society. How did this happen? The interlocking systems of patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy did their work, dehumanizing and converting other people to their use. A prime example of a servant institution of patriarchal white supremacist capitalism is the enforcement prison punishment system. I wish it could be said that we've moved beyond the slave patrols and their role in protecting white property. It sometimes feels like we're living in an endless adaptation of the Scottsboro Boys or Emmett Till and a thousand other personal tragedies. This is the horror of Ava DuVernay's account of the roundup of the Central Park Five, When They See Us, which follows the legacy of hunting down people like animals, wilding boys, treeing people like dogs. The thoughtless violence extends to Trayvon Martin and Philando Castile to today. By now, black people know that the police are deployed to protect the peace and the property and the interests of white citizenry. And when you think about the way in which authority has been used throughout history, the Pinkertons, security agents paid to protect the corporate property of the railroad magnates of the robber baron era, the parallels are clear. Consider the way in which police are used today as a prelude to displacement by conducting sweeps and moving out the poor living in areas like Bedford-Stuyvesant and now Brownsville, targeted for development and resettlement by real estate magnates. And as Marxist political economist Ruchin Kircharmer noted, the punishment system, like all institutions, evolves and adapts to changing economic conditions, like emancipation and social mandates to uphold the purity condition of the United States as a mythic white nation to contain its black non-citizens. Today, even as people work to slow the operation of criminalizing black and poor people, there remain over 2.3 million persons incarcerated in the U.S. punishment system. 60% in the federal system are black and brown. Over 70% in New York are black and brown in the state system. And at Rikers at its peak, it was close to 90%. How do we get here? As you know, the U.S. emerged in 1790, that prison system, from an anti-aristocratic social dynamic that followed the American and the French revolutions. And this led to bringing punishment inside, outside from public view and into the prison. This was in marked contrast to earlier public execution events like hanging that operated to display the power of the state and become provocative to the sensibilities of common people. This became an irritant. Prisons were also used to address the establishment's fear of new immigrants, then Irish and German, who arrived to feed the rapidly expanding U.S. labor market and was used to contain perceived social disruptors, meaning free blacks, the poor, the immigrant newcomers, often lower caste, who were viewed as dangerous to the existing established order. It should be noted that slaves were very prevalent in the North and were frequently employed as skilled labor on behalf of their owners. And in fact, Lehman Brothers invested in slaves along with the other commodities like cotton. Once punishment was moved inside, prison processes, as described by Michel Foucault in Discipline and Punish, they were used as a kind of a training ground to indoctrinate persons into the routines of early industrial capitalism, waking people at 5 a.m. with bells and horns for a day of closely supervised work. Their labor was used to subsidize the operation of the prison. That was the Auburn model. But the degree of energy and labor extraction could not compare to the post-Civil War conditions where the incarceration project was to contain and target emancipated black people who had yet to establish that they were human beings. Now, you all remember that Dred Scott had only been decided in 1857, and the main quote from that is, "The black man possesses no rights that the white man is bound to respect." Following emancipation, as we know, the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution justified returning people, almost exclusively black, to the condition of slavery through incarceration. In the South, the legal system worked in tandem with the punishment system to accomplish this objective by enacting black codes and other laws that criminalized acts like loitering and pig theft and applying hyperinflated sentencing that led through the operation of the convict lease and chain gang systems. As many of you may probably know, the convict lease system subsidized the Southern economy until 1928, and that's when it ended in Alabama. And it periodically keeps rearing its head. Joe Arpaio in Arizona tried to reinstitute it again in 1995. And here's where mostly black convicted persons were leased to private companies, engaged in incredibly dangerous work like mining or pine tar extraction or railroad construction. And you should know that at least 60 to 70% of the persons in these conditions died. There's a book by Professor Mancini, One Died, Get Another. That's really the description of the convict lease system. Its successor system, the chain gang, was responsible for building over 70% of the southern roads in this country. So we see, not only was the wealth of white individuals built by owning and using and selling slaves, but so was white societal wealth. When we talk about how the average wealth of a white family in the US is close to 10 times that of a black family, these are its roots. And so in many ways, the capitalist economy was built on the subordination of black people. And so was the concept of the white working class. As Steve Martineau and David Roediger highlight, white supremacy in the United States led to its economic formation and its class identity, particularly in unions like the AFL-CIO, where the whole notion of being in a union was being skilled and white. And the split among working people that could be defined as worker has led to the weakness of the labor movement that we still see today. So following emancipation in the late 19th century, white society attempted to further contain blacks by establishing a formal apartheid state. And I'm sure you all remember Plessy versus Ferguson. This was decided in 1896. Basically, that's a Supreme Court case that inaugurated the new Jim Crow, the state-sponsored apartheid system. And throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, apartheid and destruction were justified by narratives of black male predatory sexuality targeting white women. These narratives, among others, served to justify purging black people from towns and cities, as in Atlanta's race riot in 1906. And even when blacks stepped out of the box, and they got out of their destitution and they formed their own thriving communities like Wilmington, North Carolina, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, white mobs acted en masse to destroy and burn them. So after all of the violence and the repressive social atmosphere following World War I, blacks attempted to migrate away from the extractive labor practices secured by violence, debt peonage, sharecropping, convict lease, chain gang. And this happened all during the first and the second migrations from 1915 to 1940 and from 1940 to 1970. But when they arrived in the North, this is what they encountered. Laws and practices designed to protect white space and interests, like restrictive covenants and redlining and renewal targeting selective communities. Legislation that expressly omitted the vast majority of black workers, which at that time were farmers and domestics, from being covered under Social Security and unemployment insurance and minimum wage laws. Even after blacks gave their lives in World War II, in its aftermath, blacks were once again contained in small areas in these ghettos, often through this urban renewal planning. Banks would not lend money to blacks to buy houses in prime areas for investment because of the redlining practices. And blacks could not take full advantage of legislation like the GI Bill, which was designed to make education and loans and housing easier for veterans. So the experience of black people in the United States illustrates how the forces of white supremacy acted through and beyond capitalism, and how containment practices were linked to the expansion of the criminalization of black and brown people and the institutions of containment, which became mass incarceration. So how did this work? Our apartheid conditions have created a fundamental divide between whites and blacks. At the same time, following the Great Migrations, more blacks were living in the North and in cities like Detroit, in Philadelphia, and Chicago. And so the containment apparatus needed to grow. The demands of the civil rights movement and the black power and anti-war movements fed a sense of urgency about containing black and radical people in the 60s. So following the rebellions in northern cities, culminating after the assassination of Dr. King and the Democratic National Convention of 1968, a conservative movement that galvanized around the presidency of that candidacy of Barry Goldwater in 1964, led to a refrain of this call to law and order. And that meant really contain the black and the radical people. As it happened, the emerging legal justification for building up the punishment system to immobilize black people and disruptive white people was drugs. Drug use was presented as an acceptable justification for acting to restore social order. The state further criminalized drugs, but then labeled the black population as the major users. They were the group with a problem. And at the same time, the FBI flooded drugs into the black community so blacks could be arrested for the possession of drugs. New laws like the Rockefeller drug law secured long prison terms for drug users and sellers, requiring the building of new prisons, it was argued, which were all situated, by the way, in the upstate economy. In the upstate New York region, it was an economic boost to a flagging section of that state. And you'll see it in other states across the country where they develop prisons. It's an injection to feed a lot of those interests. At the same time, institutions that operated to separate black families grew under the compelling crisis of crack cocaine in the 1980s. It is worth noting that the recent opioid crisis that initially affected most white people is now deemed a public health crisis. After the devastation of mass incarceration and the effect of racialized unemployment, where blacks are on average unemployed at twice the rate of white people, the real estate interests in New York City became interested again in capitalizing on New York City development. And they're doing so with a vengeance. The white upper class and international capital are resettling city land that they abandoned in the 1960s and 70s when the president declared that the Bronx was burning. Doing so by mass displacement policies through real estate investment and once again, hyper-enforcement and incarceration. The result, according to the census, large numbers of black, brown, and poor people migrated out of New York City. In the last 10 years, over a million people have left New York since 2010. Instead of providing resources to help people self-determine and remain in their communities and treat historical trauma arising from the violence and the deprivation and the demonizing narratives of inferiority, black people and brown are having to scramble once again to find a place where they can afford to remain, where they can build and sustain a community. That's the reasons that reparations is so current in today's dialogue, and the reason to me that the most urgent work that can be done is to build black community resources and power through communal ownership. How could we possibly make whole the extensive, long-ranging damage arising from enslavement extending to today? This is because these harms have damaged black bodies as people, emotional beings, barring them from access to education and union membership and the tools needed to function in this society and to fully participate in the life of the community. The inability to develop an adequate remedy is no excuse for the failure to begin to develop these supports. So let's do that work together.
That's Kimberly Westcott speaking at Left Forum 2019. She is associate counsel at the Community Service Society of New York, where she works to remove barriers to employment for people with conviction histories. She's also an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University's School of Social Work. Her academic interests include social welfare policy and the process of criminalization. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. We turn now to another panel convened at Left Forum. This one was entitled Dismantling the U.S. Empire's Fake News. Danny Haifong spoke first. He is a New York City-based activist and journalist, and he's co-author with Roberto Servant of the book American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Here is Danny Haifong.
So the first point is American exceptionalism really relies on this narrative of the American dream and American prosperity. And at the core of these myths is the profit motive. The U.S. is a capitalist society where rugged individualism is celebrated and the so-called free market rarely ever questioned. The pervasiveness of American exceptionalism and innocence is a large reason why. Its purveyors in the corporate media in Washington tell us that dictators in nations such as Syria are brutalizing their own people, but rarely mention the brutality that capitalism levels upon workers and poor people right here in the USA. Instead, we are fed the narrative that the US is the most prosperous economy in human history. Here, workers can lift themselves up by their bootstraps and achieve the American dream, which is a euphemism for getting rich by working hard. Yet most Americans find themselves working harder and getting poorer. Black America, for example, according to the Economic Policy Institute, is in many ways in worse economic condition than in 1968. Black America possesses a higher unemployment rate than in 1968 and is dangerously close to possessing zero wealth by 2050 if current trends persist. This sounds more like what Malcolm X called an American nightmare rather than an American dream. The myth of the American dream, which is regurgitated ad nauseum by corporate sporting leagues such as the NBA and figures such as Ellen and Oprah, make us feel that prosperity is in reach when in fact we are being fleeced by an entrenched oligarchy. This oligarchy became fat from slavery and indigenous genocide, then took its system global to become the most formidable empire on the planet. After World War II, the US comprised of over half of the world's gross domestic product. This is when the myth of the American dream reached its peak popularity. Some economists have called this age the golden age of capitalism. Indeed, living standards for millions of people improved as a result of the massive expansion of the war industry and redistributive policies that were largely fought for and won by the efforts of labor. But what did the narrative of American exceptionalism and the American dream leave out? It left out millions of people who were killed as a result of US military spending during World War II. This includes the US firebombing of Dresden alongside the United Kingdom. In just one day, the US and the UK killed up to 30,000 civilians in a city that was seen as insignificant to the greater war effort and mostly about intimidating the Soviet Union. It also excludes the black Americans who remain subjected to the terrorism of Jim Crow. The myth of the Golden Age negates completely the reality that thousands of workers went on strike and forced the US capitalist class to concede the right to form a union and the right to Social Security, among other policies that improved living conditions in the post-war period. The Golden Age of American capitalism was always fleeting. During the Golden Age, anti-communism was encouraged and socialists were suppressed by McCarthyism and the FBI's COINTELPRO operations. This allowed the ideology of American exceptionalism to flourish in the labor movement, and the struggle for social justice was divided and unprepared for the assault that was to come in the mid-1970s. Wages have been stagnant since this period, and currently just three individuals, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, own more wealth than the bottom half of the US population. 4 out of 5 people in the US live paycheck to paycheck, and nearly half can't afford a $500 emergency. Thousands die in the US each year from a lack of health care, and hundreds of thousands sleep outside or in a shelter on any given night. One must really be asleep to believe in the American dream. The second point that we really stress in this book is white supremacy. And white supremacy and American exceptionalism are two peas in a pod. American exceptionalism cloaks the crimes of the US imperial state under the banner of whiteness. When this banner is challenged, the rulers of the system cry innocence. Our book doesn't seek to justify or challenge the white supremacy of Donald Trump or the political right, as vile as it is. More concerning is the ways in which American exceptionalism has been propped up by the so-called liberal opposition to President Trump. We've seen this in the ongoing Colin Kaepernick situation, which we also highlight throughout the book. The NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick was banned from the NFL for standing up to the racist military state as personified in its national anthem. Trump's comment that Kaepernick was a son of a bee and should be fired elicited an equally problematic response by those who see Trump as an embarrassment to American exceptionalist ethos. NFL owners and the corporate media demanded that the nation come together to fight Trump while ignoring the substance of Kaepernick's protests or the fact that he remains blacklisted from the NFL. American exceptionalism then not only manifests as the fiery patriotism and openly chauvinistic politics of people like Ray Moore, but also the supposedly well-intentioned reform efforts spearheaded by wealthy, self-identified liberals in the Democratic Party. The ideology reminds us that white supremacy isn't bigotry alone. It is a system of power that relies on mythologies to oppress, exploit, and destroy its targets. So American exceptionalism really equals white supremacy. The United States is the largest apartheid state in the world and the longest standing. It is a monument to white supremacy whose formation depended upon the corpses of enslaved Africans and indigenous people. The afterlives of slavery live on in the mass incarceration regime, which warehouses 2 million people, 40% of whom are black men, or the quote-unquote mud people that Wells Fargo financiers referenced when they were preying on the black community leading up to the 2007-2008 crisis. Hundreds of black Americans are killed by the police each year, and black unemployment is twice that of whites. An ideology that presumes the United States as a force for good in the world, which American exceptionalism does, must also believe that white supremacy is a force for good in the world. The third point that I want to really stress about the book is inclusion and diversity. This is a very pervasive political strand in the left at this time, and we believe it's one of the most insidious forms of American exceptionalism in this era. We have two chapters dedicated to this question of inclusion and diversity, where we argue that the focus on diversity is a response to the revolutionary movements of the 60s and 70s. These neoliberal narratives tell us that the U.S. has come a long way by drawing a straight line from the struggles of black Americans for self-determination to the rise of leaders such as Barack Obama. The same goes for the struggle for women's rights and the rise of people like Hillary Clinton. Obama, Clinton, and the so-called inclusive members of the ruling class operate as valuable weapons of counterinsurgency warfare against radical and revolutionary social transformation. Their unquestionable loyalty to Wall Street and the war machine has made this explicitly clear. Inclusion and diversity are meant to comfort us and show us that a more reformed, indeed a more civilized-looking society exists. One can find diversity initiatives in every university, or at least most universities and colleges in this country. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, recently praised right-wing Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh for hiring an all-women's clerk team. In 2016, Hillary Clinton demanded it was her turn to be the first woman commander-in-chief. The corporate media has praised the likes of Boeing and Lockheed Martin for being run by mainly women executives. And during the annual Pride celebration this year, the NSA tweeted an image of its headquarters in rainbow colors. We argue that diversity and inclusion promote a dangerous form of careerism and loyalty to the dictates of American exceptionalism, American innocence, and the imperialist nightmare that these ideologies protect. While the political right has no interest in including black Americans or anyone else deemed inferior within its ranks, the Democratic Party has become the engine of diversity. Democratic Party elites tell us that diversity is what the U.S. is all about and that the careers of individuals like Clinton, Obama, and others like Kamala Harris demonstrate that the U.S. is an indispensable nation. In the book, we criticize the politics of inclusion but avoid repeating right-wing talking points about identity politics, which are driven mainly by racial animus. We don't take part either in the debate about the virtue of representation or diversity in the abstract. Rather, we call attention to the very real impact that the politics of inclusion have had in rendering the U.S. empire a more effective evil, not a kinder one. Let's take Barack Obama. Black Agenda Report, we love talking about Barack Obama because he's been so important and so damaging to the movement. For 8 years, Barack Obama was heralded as a living example of Dr. King's dream and the struggles of black Americans for equality. And for 8 years, no matter how far Obama and his administration flanked to the right, the Democratic Party machinery told progressives and leftists that he was the change that we all deserved. Obama's 2 terms in office did indeed bring about change, but it was the type of change that benefited U.S. imperialism at the expense of oppressed and exploited people. Obama chanted, "Si se puede, yes we can," during his campaign, and then deported 2.7 million undocumented immigrants. His solution to the 2007 and 2008 economic crisis was not to punish the finance capitalists responsible as promised during the campaign, but to feed them trillions of dollars worth of public bailout money that only enhanced wealth and income inequality. Under his administration, Obama would massively expand the war on terror surveillance apparatus to the extent that the National Security Agency possessed the phone, email, and online communications of every American citizen. He also prosecuted a record number of whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917, including Chelsea Manning. By 2014, the Obama administration had transferred $750 million of military weaponry to police departments. And this increase, that was 24-fold from the Bush administration, was heavily criticized after it was found out by the Black Lives Matter movement, revealed by them, that Black Americans were being murdered by the police at a near daily rate. Obama's foreign policy was equally destructive. Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, only to tell his aides in 2012 that he was, quote, good at killing people, end quote. He wasn't lying. In contrast to just 52 drone strikes under the George W. Bush administration, the Obama administration conducted several hundred drone strikes and murdered over 4,000 people, including several American citizens, in countries such as Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, and Afghanistan. His method of signature strikes chose targets based on suspicious behavior. To the administration, this was defined as all military-aged men in the aforementioned countries. Covert warfare, such as special operations forces trained in strike and kill missions, expanded greatly under Obama to the point where they were deployed in over 70% of the world's countries. What is both dangerous and ironic is that innocence and exceptionalism, as manifested by inclusion politics, are often used to dehumanize and eliminate oppressed people. It is a politics of respectability that must be discussed further in our political organizations, activist circles, and in our communities. We must ask who and what do these politics serve? We say that they serve the war machine and the rich. Our primary goal is for readers of this book to understand that American exceptionalism and American innocence make it difficult for us to see that the U.S. is controlled by a ruling class that is ruthlessly exploiting workers and oppressed people for their own gain.
Danny Haifong is his name. He is an activist, a regular contributor to Black Agenda Report, and co-author of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. You are listening to highlights of talks given at the Left Forum 2019 conference. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We move now to another speaker at the same panel. Glenn Ford is executive editor of Black Agenda Report, and he wrote the afterword to Danny Haifong and Roberto Servent's book. Here's Glenn Ford speaking on June 29th, 2019 at LIU Brooklyn.
Exceptionalism is baked in to the American narrative and into the American popular consciousness. And saying that exceptionalism is baked in really is just another way of saying that lies are baked in. The U.S. mythology is a lie. It is a fallacy. The U.S. corporate media, their job is to every day create a narrative for what is going on in the world that makes the United States seem exceptional and a force for good, and alternatively, one that is under attack from every Lilliputian in the world all the time. Now, I think it's important that this book really examine at so many levels the baked into-ness of white supremacy in the American history. Because even people on the left, since it has been so baked in, don't recognize the primacy of white supremacy as part of, as the mission of these folks nearly enough. The brother was talking about U.S. empire today. Well, these founding fathers, they thought of what they were doing even before they had defeated the British colonial army. They thought, and they verbalized it, that they were putting in motion an incipient empire. For them, coming from a much smaller place, Europe, a small country, many of them had disembarked from Holland, little tiny places when you get to a U.S. scale. And here they were looking out across this continent saying, all of that should by right be ours. Meanwhile, there are more people living on that continent than their little colonies on the eastern fringe. But they believed that they had it by, they said divine right, but everything they did and also said by racial right, because these people were not human beings. So in their Declaration of Independence, their founding document before there actually is a government, they blame the Brits. They explain why they want to separate from the Brits by saying that the British are exhorting the savages, meaning the Native Americans, against us, and they are encouraging the slaves to revolt. Well, so that is their justification for separating from the British, because the British would not allow them to continue their unlimited depredations against the native people with whom the British had agreements. And the British settlers thought might be too amenable to the prospect of eventual emancipation. So they had to get out of there. So this place was founded on the maintenance of white supremacy and the expansion of white supremacy. And it's only in very, very recent years that they have found it necessary to cloak that whole history. We need to look at the United States as a white settler nation. And if we do, then everything that it in fact has done in history makes great sense. And that history of the development and expansion of a white settler nation goes directly to the present day. The United States' closest relationships with other nations in the world is with what's commonly called the Five Eyes. The Five Eyes are the United States, Canada, Britain, New Zealand, and Australia. The United States shares almost all of its intelligence on a regular basis, that is, day to day, not upon request, you get it when I got it, with those five nations. And who are those nations? They are Britain and its white settler states, colonies. The United States had to go through a makeover of the stories that it told internally and the stories that it told externally, the lies to others and to itself after World War II, as it becomes the superpower, the unchallenged superpower on the capitalist side of the ledger. But that is a period of decolonization. And the Soviet Union, and I don't want to hear people talking about Stalinism and all that stuff, the Soviet Union being a champion of decolonization in the world and having given material aid to liberation movements in the world was the ideological competitor with the United States with these emerging nations. And so the U.S. had to radically change its clothing. I think one of the most dramatic crises that the United States faced as it tried to put on these new inclusive and racially progressive clothes that really didn't fit at all was with the Little Rock crisis. That is when these young black kids were trying to integrate the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, and these mobs of thousands of white people, most of them white women, turned out screaming, spitting, cursing, threatening to kill these little kids, half of them drunk. It was a real spectacle. The United States did not look well in that spectacle, and that was one of the first stories of modern television. This is before Birmingham, 1957 in Little Rock, and it was a profound embarrassment to the United States. And so we see President Eisenhower, who was a racist and segregationist himself. He had opposed the desegregation of the army, so we know how he stood on that. Sent in the troops because he had to, in order to forcibly change the clothes of the United States. But we need to know what actually motivates Americans and what are the precursors of the institutions that we struggle against today. We have to understand that the United States was the world's first racially regimented society. And it was a big country. It wasn't like Liechtenstein deciding to racially regiment people. This was a huge and the most dynamic, because of slavery preceding this, the most economically dynamic country in the world. And they set about the project, this is during Jim Crow, post-emancipation, of creating the first fully racially regimented society. And Hitler admired that, and he said so. That's what he wanted to do with his country, and this big, vibrant country had already done it. And of course, South Africa admired that. That's what they wanted to do in the country in which they were the minority. So the United States has not just been embarrassing in its racial peccadilloes. It is the champion of white supremacy in the world. And it does affect people who become or even who have been lifelong leftists. It's only been a matter of maybe 4 or 5 years or so that we on the left have been speaking as if everybody knew that U.S. chattel slavery was a distinct form of capitalism, one that had institutions that resemble financial instruments that are used today, that were in fact the generally used instruments to secure slave populations in the 1800s. But I remember that even people who called themselves Marxists wanted to put slavery off to the side somewhere, that it had its own rules, and that labor relationships and the super exploitation and the speed ups on the plantations, well, that didn't have much to do with free labor and the struggles of free labor. This can only be explained. That is, that American Marxists would go to such lengths to distort their own analyses, to somehow put slavery and therefore the race question off to the side and call it some kind of other phenomenon rather than being a very distinct capitalistic institution that in fact was the engine that catapulted the United States into the world power status that it gained.
Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, speaking at last year's Left Forum. Black Agenda Report sponsored the panel he was a part of. This session had the title Dismantling the U.S. Empire's Fake News. We have time to present portions of a third panelist from that session. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights attorney and the author, most recently, of The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Here is Dan Kovalik.
I think American exceptionalism is a quite entertaining subject, because if it weren't so sad, it's actually quite funny. And so here is one example that I think goes along really well with Danny's book. This is a title from The Onion recently. Bolton argues war with Iran, only way to avenge Americans killed in upcoming war with Iran. Now, this is hilarious. It is, and it's silly, and yet it really encapsulates part of what Danny's talking about in the book, about American innocence and about America as the victim. And no matter what situation, I'll give you a good example where this logic that The Onion discerns was used, and I was just amazed, and maybe some of you in the room remember this. So in the early days of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there were these two Defense Department spokespeople, a guy and a blonde woman, who would go on TV every day and explain to the American people what was happening with the advance, the heroic advance of the Americans into Iraq. And at least on one occasion, they said, look, we have to tell you what happened today. American vehicles and tanks, we rolled in to Iraq, and we were met by a pregnant woman who stopped the vehicles only as a pretense to throw a bomb or hand grenade at one of the tanks. And I'm not kidding when I say that they said, this proves why we needed to invade Iraq, because this is the type of people they are. They send pregnant women to attack our vehicles. They literally said this. This is John Bolton's reasoning. We had to invade Iraq because of the way they would defend us when we invade. And similarly, the statement was made about Venezuela. I believe it was John Bolton or Mike Pompeo, I don't know, remember which, but they said, trust me, if we invade Venezuela, they will kill American soldiers. And so this is part of this, again, incredible ideology, which again, on its face, when you look at it, it is amusing and crazy, and yet it is believed. Even if people don't know what the words American exceptionalism mean, inside, they carry this with them every day. Actually, I wanted, one of the things Danny said, it made me think of another quote. Actually, one of the best quotes about American exceptionalism I've heard recently was a couple years ago, and this is the quote, and then I'll tell you who said it. He said that we judge ourselves by the best of our intentions, and we judge others by the worst of their conduct. And think about that. It's absolutely true, right? If we kill 2 to 4 million people in Vietnam, it's kind of an oops. Sorry, we meant well. Yeah, we do horrible things once in a while, but we're nice guys. If other countries do bad things, whether they're real bad things or imagined or made up, it defines who they are. They're bad, right? This was a quote by George W. Bush in 2016. I think the one interesting thing about American exceptionalism, as the book goes into, is that it is based on a number of things. It's based on untruths, but it's also based on an unwillingness to face who we are. In 1905, the Democratic National Platform had this in the platform. It said that a country cannot exist one half Republican, one half empire, which actually is a quite profound statement and pretty important today when we're probably a quarter Republican, 75% empire, if it's even that good. However, at the moment, and for some time, the U.S. has refused to recognize itself as an empire. It's the only empire that has ever existed on this planet that hasn't admitted it's an empire. Meanwhile, the Romans had 33 international bases, military bases, when they had their empire. The British, at the height of their empire, had 36 international military bases. The U.S. has at least 800 international military bases, but we're not an empire. It's really one of the most incredible mind games ever played. Which also, and the other thing this book that I like about American exceptionalism, it gets into also popular culture and Hollywood as promoters of American exceptionalism. You know, in one movie, of course, that comes to mind when you talk about empire is Star Wars, right? Where the empire is so important, right? The whole struggle is by the fledgling rebel group and the empire. And when I was growing up, and I assume like a lot of kids my age, because I was 7 or 8 or something at the time I first saw Star Wars, I identified with the rebels and thought that that was the U.S., right, fighting against maybe the Soviet Empire or an imaginary empire. It didn't matter. But as I later grew up, I realized how absurd that was. But my guess is that's most how most Americans think. Meanwhile, those on the left, I learned later, those who had grown up in the 60s, thought immediately that the rebels had to be the Vietnamese fighting the United States, which actually makes a lot more sense, right? But that's how we've really turned the world upside down in this doctrine of American exceptionalism. And the other part of the innocence and the victimhood is also the no right of others to defend themselves against us. That's a very important part of all this. You look at Vietnam, for example, and what was the causes belli of the big congressional authorization of the war in Vietnam was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. First of all, it didn't happen. Okay, let's start with that premise. But what was said to have happened, that the Vietnamese attacked 2 U.S. naval ships in international waters while the U.S. was pounding Vietnam with napalm and Agent Orange, mercilessly treated, including women and children. This goes back to the founding of our country. And that's why now with Iran, the U.S., again, incredible notions of entitlement the U.S. has. Again, a part of American exceptionalism. U.S. sends naval ships, troops, drones, etc., to the Persian Gulf, where the Iranians live, and says, we want to fight. We want to fight you. Starts shooting stuff into the air, including drones, and then when one is shot down, you're attacking us. How is that possible that we're the ones being attacked, that we're the victims? But again, it is that underpinning of American exceptionalism that is so important to them. One of the very important and the most spoiled children of American exceptionalism is humanitarian interventionism, another subject of the book, right? Which is now, I believe, competing doctrine, which is maybe the most strong pro-war doctrine I've ever seen. And humanitarian interventionism, or R2P, responsibility to protect, these are doctrines, again, very linked to and come from American exceptionalism. They are the ideas that the West and the U.S. in particular not only may, but must intervene around the world in defense of human rights. And it is such a powerful doctrine that people, including and especially liberals, tend to believe if the U.S. is not bombing somewhere, the U.S. is not upholding human rights principles. Again, that sounds outrageous, but let's take a recent example. After one of the alleged chemical attacks in Syria, Trump responded by a bombing raid in Damascus near the airport. I believe that's what he hit. In any case, he was applauded by the liberal media, by liberal pundits, as acting presidential. Do you remember that? It's one of the few times they acknowledged that he was acting presidential. Why? Because the U.S. must act militarily in order for human rights to be upheld. That is an assumption. When, of course, the real assumption people should have is that for human rights around the world to be protected, the U.S. must refrain from intervention and must stay home.
Dan Kovalik, labor and human rights attorney, author most recently of The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and adjunct law professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He spoke at Left Forum 2019. I want to thank Wilton Vaught, who furnished the audio presented today. As I mentioned earlier, Left Forum's 2020 conference, originally scheduled for late May in New York City, has been canceled due to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.